Welcome back to another episode of Inside Rock. This week, Rush Part 2.
All right, that sounds awesome.
Well, Rush was so huge that we had to break it up into two parts.
All right, sounds good. And we've also brought back our favorite Rush fan. And
the stripper?
No, I guess she's still delivering pizzas. I told you that.
Okay, sorry.
No, we brought back the Giz. Welcome back, Giz.
How you doing, everybody?
So we had to bring back the expert, the Rush expert. I mean, you're self-proclaimed, or are you an expert?
Well, he's got a room.
Who's the expert?
He's got a room in his house that's like a little museum for Rush.
You have Neil Peart drumsticks, don't you?
I do.
I know. That's the first thing I noticed when I walked in.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Actually, you know what's funny? It's a Rush episode, but Queeks is wearing an AC/DC shirt.
Listen, nobody can see it. I got to wear a shirt music-related each show, and I just happen to have probably most AC/DC shirts.
Yeah, I can't say much. I'm wearing Led Zeppelin, so... Underneath this.
Oh, I'm going to say
I'm not familiar with that one.
He's, no. He's wearing a hoodie.
Yeah. I didn't know that Led Zeppelin was called New Jersey. All right. So let's move on to part two of Rush. And we're picking this up from, what, the early 80s, Giz? That's where we are?
Yeah, Permanent Waves.
Mm-hmm.
And what a way to start the 80s with the rest of, well, unlike a lot of other bands in the 80s, the hair metal bands and everything else. But for Rush, it was a move to shorter songs and getting away from the long opuses that they used to have.
Well, like I said, it was tough on Neil.
Yeah, it was taking its toll on him.
Taking their toll. One of the cool things about this album, because there is a little bit of kind of reggae kind of tinge to it, in particular in Spirit of Radio. And you know who kind of inspired Neil for that reggae that they added? Think
Bob
about the
Marley.
Early 80s.
Bob Marley.
Actually, it was the Police.
I knew it.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Knew it. Well, Bob, when did Bob Marley die? I mean, he died. Okay.
Yeah.
Now we need an answer.
We're not sure. We'll look that up.
Yeah, okay. We'll look it up at the Bob Marley episode.
But Neil and Copeland were really close friends. And so Neil always said that they were really inspired by what other bands were doing at the time. And he really liked that reggae kind of stuff that the Police were really playing around with back then. So they wanted to include some, which they did actually for a couple albums in the 80s. It's in Signals as well.
Hmm. And Copeland, he was a great drummer as well.
He was. He is.
Yes, yeah. He is. That's right.
And just for the record, Bob Marley died in May of 1981. So, it was right around that time.
Right around that
time. Well, who knows? Maybe he was also inspired by that too. Yeah, you never know, right? Yeah. But no, it was a great album. And they were still working with Terry Brown and at Moran Heights, the studio in Quebec as well, which is... has been a big part of Rush's career. And the next album we'll talk about was probably the most well-known one that was made at Le Studio, which no longer exists, by the way.
No, it doesn't. That's a shame. And whenever I hear about that studio, I always think about Tom Sawyer, the video.
Yeah, it's a classic.
It is a classic. But Permanent Waves, actually. Mm-hmm. What, Queeks?
Oh, no. I'm just trying to keep up with the information here.
Oh, okay. Permanent Waves actually was their most successful release at that time,
to date.
Yeah, to date.
That was 1980, right?
1980, yeah. The fans were waiting for it.
Yep. You know, we skipped over a little bit of information. In 1980, they joined Max Webster and they recorded Battle Scar. You remember that?
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, that's
right. Awesome. And that was actually in 1980 as well. That was for Universal Juveniles album, Max Webster.
Gotta love Max
Webster. That's a great tune. I love Battle Scar.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. It's a great song.
Anyway, I just wanted to throw that in there because that was the same year.
Very good. Okay, so Permanent Waves. They get a little bit different style, as Giz said, a little bit shorter songs, giving Neil Peart a little bit of a break. Then what? Then where to go from there?
Well, I mean, if we want to move off of Permanent Waves, we go to what was really their largest album at the time and really kind of paved the way. Maybe what they would consider the second stage of their growth after 2112, which was really the early 70s kind of launch to the next level of their superstardom. And then Moving Pictures was just an absolute crazy beast, how it changed their... change the direction of the band, but also just their popularity was just was unreal.
And this was like 1 year later.
Yeah, one year later.
You know, but all these bands, it took 10, 15 years to come up with album number two. And here's Rush with 1980, 1981, and actually they did another one, 82, which we'll get to. But yeah, Moving Pictures, 1981.
Yeah, and Neil always said that this is where, this is what he always envisioned that Rush would sound like. This is where he felt like they finally had found their footing. This is the Rush that he was really, really proud of.
Well, and again, the most memorable track on that one is Tom Sawyer.
Yeah, of a bunch of really awesome tracks. Personally, for me, because most people who aren't Rush fans can at least name Red Barchetta and Tom Sawyer, but
Working
it's,
Man,
it's side Man. Two to me that is just incredible on this album.
You know, Pye Dubois from Max Webster, the lyricist, he offered the band, after they were working with him with Battlescar, on the song Battlescar, he offered him some lyrics he had written for a song, and Neil Peart reworked them and turned that into Tom Sawyer.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah, boom.
Good to know.
Yeah. He actually co-wrote a few songs later as well. He's probably co-written three or four songs over Rush's career. But that album was just incredible. And the second side, The Camera Eye, that's one of my favorite songs. And they actually filmed or recorded live segments in New York and London. And if you listen to the song, that's what it talks about, is both of those cities. And they actually recorded street noise and people actually on both in both cities and put it in that song. Mm,
that's cool. Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Actually, one of my favorite songs is on that album. It's YYZ.
Yes.
I love that song.
Everybody calls it YYZ. I mean, Americanized, but
yeah.
YYZ.
It is YYZ. You're right.
That's right.
And what is YYZ?
It's the airport code for Toronto.
For Toronto. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm sure you know this, but when they tap out the beginning part on the cymbals, that's Neil tapping out YYZ in Morse code.
Shut up.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Nice, Giz. See, that's why he's here, right?
Okay, Giz, you can go now.
Yeah. So you go back and listen to that later and go, oh,
That's pretty cool.
And you know why you do that? Because when you're a pilot and you're going toward an airport, you have to check the identifier. And the identifier is given back to you in Morse code, and that's how you check it.
Really?
Really? Yeah.
You know, that's Neil. He was so damn smart, that guy, and he put things in that where you didn't know. You had to really dig in order to know that these things were in the songs. But yeah, it was one of the really cool things when I heard that.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. See, listen to the Jabber guys on Inside Rock, and you get a little bit of the background information.
Damn straight.
There you go. So now, moving into the 80s, they really started to change some of their style and technique. They started to bring in things like synthesizers, which, and the pianos.
They didn't agree on that, did they?
No, well.
No.
I mean, the band got along. We already talked about that in part one, how cohesive they were.
Well, Alex and Getty didn't agree on the synthesizer and the piano stuff.
Yeah.
But Alex, to his credit, said, well, we'll give it a shot. And they did some songs. So we'll talk a little bit about how they got into that.
Hey, maybe that's where Van Halen got their inspiration from, for Jump, the keyboards. Because that was another band that introduced keyboards, and it had huge success with it, actually.
Wow. And you mentioned 80s were dripping with keyboards.
Yeah, they were. But I mean, it's amazing, because Rush were using keyboards long before that, but it's just they weren't the forefront. And then the 80s, it was the whole synth era, and they kind of jumped in with both feet and both hands. And Alex is, he's always been pretty good about it in interviews, but you can tell when we get into the 90s that they finally...
Enough of that shit.
Yeah.
Well, it was Signals, 1982, where they really launched some of the technique, correct?
Yeah, well, they used it a lot.
Moving Pictures, they started with the keyboard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did, but it always seemed very textural, but then it became almost... an instrument on its own. It's they actually thought about adding a keyboard player back at that time as a touring musician, and they apparently talked about it and said, no, we're three of us, we're going to figure it out.
Well, why mess it up the dynamic? You bring in another person, that great dynamic that they had could have been upset.
Yeah, so they never, ever, ever did, despite all the... the way that they can sound on stage, and it's only three people, it's pretty crazy.
40 years together as the trio.
Yes, it is. It's a long time.
So let's talk a little bit about the synthesizer applications and signals.
Yeah, well, I mean, subdivisions, that's the classic, right? It starts with it. And mm-hmm. the first time I ever saw Rush, which was 88, it was the Hold Your Fire tour, which we'll get to that later. But they did start many of their tours with subdivisions. That's the first Rush song I ever heard live. And that's where, for sure, synthesizers and keyboards were used heavily, was in this album.
Right.
But then also, electric violin.
Hmm. Who played the electric violin? That's right.
Yeah.
Ben Mink.
Ben Mink from FM, who actually, and we probably won't get a chance to talk about it, but when Getty did do his solo album, Ben Mink is a close friend of Getty's, and Ben actually played all of the, most of the guitars and some violin on Getty's solo album that he made as well. But Ben Mink did that solo, and if you listen to it, there's a guitar solo mixed in with it. So Alex is actually soloing over the electric violin, which is really cool.
And we should remind everybody that Chaz is going to be putting together a playlist so you can hear all these. We'll compile the songs we're talking about in this episode into a Rush Part 2 playlist that you can find on Spotify.
Well, by the time we launch this, they'll be able to have it opened and listen to the song as we talk about them.
Really?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Why not?
Maybe that's what we should do. Do one podcast like... You know how if you play a Pink Floyd album with The Wizard of Oz, it kind of goes along?
Time it.
Mm. Yeah, we should do that.
Cool.
But with the album Oingo Boingo.
Dead Man's Party?
That's right.
Yeah, I can see how that's going to work out.
Yeah. All right, so moving on. And what this wasn't this the album they had their biggest hit?
No.
Well, one of their biggest hits for sure. Subdivisions was one of the big ones. But it's interesting. New World Man also did really, really well as well. But
yeah, New World Man is what I'm talking about.
This is the album. You know, you remember the days when you used to be able, well, you can still buy records, but back when records were the main thing you bought. And, you know, bands like Rush and other bands really took advantage of the inner sleeves and mm-hmm. did, you know, alternate covers and everything else.
It's a lot of work.
And this album... really showcase Getty's love of baseball. And it's maybe not that well known that he's actually one of the largest collectors of baseball memorabilia in the world. And in particular, the Negro Baseball League, which is from the early 1900s, he actually owns the largest collection from that
really?
From that league.
Wow.
But on the inside of this album cover is a... And the whole thing about signals were... people giving off signals and there's actually a baseball diamond and one of Getty's close friends was Warren Cromartie.
Oh.
And so he did a whole, if you ever look on the inside cover of Signals, you'll see a baseball diamond and they just use a lot of references to baseball on it and different place names and whatnot. Hmm. Yeah, it's really neat.
Now, is he a Jays fan? He's got to be a Jays fan.
Yes, well, Getty's, if you ever watch a lot of baseball, you'll see Getty sitting behind home plate
sometimes,
just about every single game. Yeah. Yeah, so he's a huge Blue Jays.
Toronto Blue Jays.
Blue Jays fan as well.
Wasn't it him early on tour, they'd go back to the hotel and they'd put on the TV and a lot of times there was just baseball on, and isn't that how he got hooked on it?
Yeah. He used to just watch baseball all the time. Whatever city he was in, he would always try to take in a game as well.
Yeah.
They all had, you know, weird hobbies like that just to keep themselves from becoming drug addicts and whatever else.
Well,
you know, they played tennis. Actually, Alex Lifeson has his pilot's license. So for quite a while, he was working towards his pilot's license. He's actually a certified licensed pilot. Yeah.
Very good. A brother.
There you go. So he did that for quite a while back in the early 80s as well. He just said, I'll learn this. So it's pretty cool.
Well, I remember what Getty saying that music was just one aspect of their lives. Like they were family guys too. And they were like pilots and this and that. So they just didn't want music taking over their whole lives. So it was just one aspect of it.
I think that's what I find most impressive about this band is how they were so balanced. They didn't get involved in the, you know, sex, drugs, crap that a lot of mm-hmm. the other bands fell into, and they got along. There weren't fights, and they're just three friends working together.
They stayed married.
They stayed married. Yeah,
and they're still friends.
Yeah.
It's very weird, actually.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah, and you never had the same drama. I'm just reading about Chris Cornell now. They're talking about the early days of Soundgarden, and they used to tour with Guns N' Roses back in 1991.
This is a shit show, and, right
there. And they said, like, we probably would have done a lot better if like the concerts actually ever went ahead, but they kept getting canceled all the time, so they never played. Like, they would go to Denmark and Axl wouldn't show up, and so end of the show. So no one ever got to see Soundgarden.
Slash was a bit of a train wreck too.
They all were. Yeah. We'll talk. Well, we can talk about Guns N' Roses some other time. But you know, Duff McKagan actually has a master's in economics. After Guns N' Roses first broke up, he got clean, and then he went back to school and got his master's in economics. Wow. Smart guy. Yeah.
It's like that episode.
Some non-rush trivia for you.
It's like that episode where Homer gets whacked over the head and he turns normal. Like a normal guy. And then he gets whacked again and he goes back to Homer. So I don't know where that came from. Have you seen that, Queeks? Have you seen that episode?
I don't really watch The Simpsons.
Oh, my God.
No, I don't. I don't. I used to watch them way back at season 1 and 2, but now it's what, season 38? What is it?
Well, yeah, I don't
think. It's one of the longest running TV shows ever.
It just and the number of guests on a show. It's just, it's crazy.
I think it just edged out Gunsmoke as the longest running TV show.
Gunsmoke was on that long?
Gunsmoke and the Flintstones.
Yeah.
There we go. We just start to digress.
What show are we doing again?
But you know that the interesting thing about Signals, to go back to Signals,
Rush.
Two.
It's a good thing Giz is here.
We're going to need a part three if we keep this up. But this was the last one they did with Terry Brown. And so Terry was not happy with this whole new direction of moving towards keyboards. And so this is the last time they worked with Terry Brown, who they'd worked with since Fly By Night.
But
so
they let him go.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's always been handled very kind of, you know, you don't hear a lot about it, but you can read between the lines that there was a lot of tension about that.
Yeah, he wasn't happy either. He didn't want to do that kind of music.
Well, but I heard, Terry was actually, it caught him by surprise though.
Yeah.
That is letting him go. But they stayed friends. It was just difference of an opinion.
Well, it was a business decision, you know?
Yeah, that's right. So they did what they had to do. Okay, where do we move from here, Giz?
Well, now we got to move into
Grace Under Pressure,
which...
1984. And again, 80, 81, 82, 84. Like, they were just prolific when it came to putting out great albums.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just funny when you think of a band like Boston that did, I don't know, 6, 7 albums? I don't know. The last two are absolute crud, but it took 4, 5, 6 years between albums.
Well, one was like almost 13 years.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But Grace Under Pressure was another...
Third Stage, you mean.
Third Stage, yeah.
Third Stage, yeah. It was still a great album. Anyway, but... Yeah, moving into Grace Under Pressure, this was also recorded in the winter, and I guess they were really inspired by a lot by Getty's family's experiences during the Holocaust. There's a couple of songs that really are really dark and from a very non-direct way are memories that Getty shared with him about his parents and their experiences in the war, when they actually had met in a Holocaust camp. And so a lot of this album is really dark. It's very keyboard heavy. I really like it. But at the time, this is probably the one that really started to piss off most traditional Rush fans because it really moved into keyboards.
It did
very, very heavy. And it did not really equate with most Rush fans.
Yeah, maybe Terry Brown is right.
Well, and, you know, like you said, Terry Brown was not with them anymore, so they had to find a new producer.
Yeah.
And they went with this guy, or they tried to get this guy called Steve Lillywhite.
Yeah.
And I guess he'd done work with Simple Minds before. And
U2 as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was, that whole combination of Brian Eno and Steve Lillywhite had done a lot of work with U2 back then. But
then this guy left him standing there and said, after he took him so far down the road, said he was going to do it. And he's like, I got a better offer from Simple Minds. Bye-bye.
and it left them in a tough spot. But they ended up, Peter Henderson they brought on.
Peter Henderson. Yeah, and like I said, this was heavily synthesized, and the Simmon drums, which I was just reading the other day about that, they're really, really rare. If you can come across a pair of Simmons drum pads now, you have a small fortune on your hands.
So those are electronic drum pads.
Yeah, right? They're electronic drum. And that's where he really started to use those heavily, and he did for the rest of the 80s.
Yeah, I have to admit, I was put off a little bit with this album. I don't know.
But you didn't like it, Chuck?
Well, no. It is just too much of a change. Mm. It's just it's a little too different.
And the change being the synthesizers and the keyboards and stuff?
Yeah, and actually seeing Neil at those
electronic drums.
Like, I don't know. It was just too much all of a sudden. It's like, what the hell are they doing?
Yeah, but it also missed anything resembling a song that was a hit. And that was the real problem. It really was deemed as inaccessible. It was really what most people would consider deep cuts, but they all happened to be on one album. And so not everyone was really attuned with it. Yeah, it was a tough follow-up after Signals. And they even say in interviews that this was a slog to make. It was the dead of winter in Quebec, and it just was not an enjoyable experience. A lot of it brought on by the fact they had the troubles with the producers as well. But again, Alex was getting increasingly pissed off about the reliance on keyboards too, and this album really, really showed that. I actually really like the album. There's other Rush albums that I don't like as much as Grace Under Pressure, but this was another kind of album that led to an easing off of keyboards after this as well, where they were a little more in the background than they are on this album.
You know what? You got to give them credit, though, for trying, you know, trying something new, taking a different. I mean, if they listened to everybody before they released, Hemispheres, was it? Was it Hemisphere? Which one was it they were getting criticized and they said, no, we're going to do it. Oh, 2112.
2112.
That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah, so they said, no, we're going to do it anyway. And it was a big leap for them, right, to do something really progressive like that, and it worked.
Yeah.
So you got to give them credit for trying something different.
Well, it reached number 5 in Canada.
Yeah.
There was some success to it, right?
Yeah. 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 Okay, so where do we go from this album?
Well, Power Windows. I think I saw Power Windows tour twice.
Really?
And again, 1985, they just keep on going.
The sound quality. I remember you saying, Creeks, you've been to a few concerts that stick out.
What? So I always said,
one is Priest.
Oh my God. It was like listening to a CD.
Yeah.
It was that clear.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
And I found that almost every Rush concert I was at, just the precision of everything. It sounded beautiful.
Yeah, it was always something to see them play live. This album, I really liked it, but you can see a huge difference stylistically when they move from Grace Under Pressure to this. And they do strip away some of the keyboards. They replace it with strings in a couple of songs as well, which was something new. Not new, they had used strings, violin anyway, and Losing It on Signals. But
they also had a new producer for this one too.
Yeah, Peter Collins.
Peter Collins, right.
Yeah, and they recorded this one in a few studios, but mostly in England as well, which, of course, they had done a couple of the albums in the 70s in England as well. So they kind of went back there to kind of get a little bit of a different approach to things as well. And it really worked. I actually really like this album. It's another one that kind of introduced, Big Money was, kind of that lead single.
That ended up a top 50 hit in Canada.
Yeah. It replaced Subdivisions as the opening song on those tours for this tour and for Hold Your Fire as well. So it became the new lead-off song for the concerts. Yeah.
You know what reminds me when I think of Power Windows? I bought the CD. And I remember I was so quick to buy the CD because that was the first Rush album that was triple D, digitally recorded, really? Digitally mixed, and digitally mastered. Yeah. It's like, oh my God, this is amazing. Finally, a pure digital Rush album.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always get a kick out of, like, their albums are always it's the design of them that's always so unique too, with Hugh Syme doing all of their album covers, and everything's always kind of tongue-in-cheek and has a little bit of a personality to it. And even this one, Power Windows, with, you know, the guy just looking out a window, and he's got a remote control in his hand. And
the TV's at his back, but yeah, he's got the remote at the window.
But he's opening the window of the world, right, with the remote control. It's really, it's just kind of interesting the way they did that. But this was a great album. And again, showcasing some of Neil's love of history and whatnot, they... Manhattan Project, which was a song they did about Hiroshima and the dropping of the atomic bomb. And just, yeah, it was just really good. I thought it was a really good album. And again, a big departure just in kind of the feel and the tone of it from Grace Under Pressure. So,
yeah.
And then they followed up Grace Under Pressure with Hold Your Fire. And that was only 2 years later.
Yeah. And that's the first time I ever saw Rush. Was Hold Your Fire.
Where'd you see him?
Finally.
You mean they followed up Power Windows?
Power Windows.
Oh, I'm sorry. What did I say?
You said Grace Under
Pressure. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Okay. You're right. Yeah, they followed up Power Windows with Hold Your Fire.
Yeah. That's back in the old days. Remember when you used to just get general admission tickets? And so growing up in Newfoundland, and this was the first time I ever had a chance to see any band. No bands ever came to Newfoundland. And Rush had never played there before, and they never played there again.
So you saw them the only time they were there.
Yeah, and of course, back then it was Memorial Stadium. It was a little hockey rink that probably sat 5,000 or 6,000 people, maybe. But it was general admission, and I literally camped out overnight so I could be the first person in the lineup to get a ticket. And I was, which of course didn't guarantee you anything, because they were all general admission.
Guaranteed to get you trampled.
You just got in. And then the night they actually played two nights back to back, and so I also wanted to be the first person in the arena. So I lined up a day and a half early to just stay there and wait by the door. And I was the first person in, and I stood up. Yeah. Yeah. I stood.
I've only done that once.
Did you not have a job?
I probably did, but for those few days, didn't matter. I was actually first year university. I skipped every class for 2 days just so I could do that. And so I stood right in front of Getty on the first night. And then the second night, I wanted to see all the lights. So I went right to the very back and watched it from the back.
Oh, so you bought more than one ticket.
Yeah. Oh, it was probably four or five of my friends that went with me on the first night. My sister, my youngest sister, she wanted to go to a concert with me. So she came with me on the second night. Actually, no, she came on the first night, actually, and I was with just one other friend on the second night. But anyway, that was quite a memory from back then to have seen them. And that's where I actually got the Neil Peart drumsticks. Oh. And there's a little story behind that. My cousin was the director of security at the stadium, and he knew how much of a Rush fan I was. And he said, "Gary, listen, if there's anything left on that stage when Neil or the rest of the guys get off there, I'm grabbing it for you." And so this cousin of mine, as soon as the concert was over, he went up on stage and he just grabbed a couple of sticks that were laying next to Neil's drum kit. And they were played, as you guys have seen them. They were played that night. And so I've had those ever since. So that was really the only thing I got from that night.
But oh, I thought she was going to say maybe some drumsticks, like pick, and here's Getty's wallet.
Yeah, I wish. Yeah, I wish there. Yeah, that would have been nice. But it was a great memory. Yeah.
Yeah, speaking about camping out for a show, I've only done that once. I did it for Springsteen in 1980 for the River Tour in Toronto. And it was cold, too, because it was, I believe...
How
it
was cold was it?
Colder than a witch's tit, right, Chuck?
Yeah. It was so cold, I saw a dog stuck to a fire hydrant.
Oh, buddy, that's so old. You man, you're... Wow.
Well...
Yeah, I know. Hey,
that's cold, man.
Yeah, it's cold.
All right. But anyway, I did that. It's the only time. Quite frankly, I don't think I'd do it again.
No.
I don't think so. Well, Chai, you ever camped out for anything?
Twice, both for my daughter. Once was going up into Toronto. It was like minus 15. We had to wait outside.
Oh, must have been a great concert then.
It wasn't a concert. It was a CD signing for Cody Simpson.
Cody Simpson.
Froze our ass off. Yeah, my daughter and I, we had fun. I froze my ass off. And then the other time was to get tickets, and we got there early. And again, I 4 hours outside, freezing my ass off.
Tickets for what?
Menudo.
Cody Simpson.
Menudo.
Again? Who the hell is Cody Simpson?
Who is Cody Simpson? Who is that, Chuck?
It's a kid from Australia, I believe.
He's a music artist.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
You said a book signing.
Did you say CD signing?
Oh, CD signing, not a book signing. Yeah. Okay, whatever. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I remember saying to my daughter, okay, do you want to, because there's a Starbucks, it's like at the corner. You want a coffee? Yeah, that'd be great. That's warm. I went in, got a coffee, and I'm about to walk back out like, am I fucking stupid? I sit down, crack open a book, drink off my coffee. Yeah, I think I better go back out there. Go back. Dad, why is my coffee? Coffee's not very warm. I know those Starbucks bastards.
I'm not going to get Starbucks for a sponsor
there's
now.
This show is not brought to you by Starbucks.
That's right. Oh, boy. Well, listen, a couple of little interesting things about Hold Your Fire. They finally featured a guest vocalist.
Amy, I've been waiting for this.
Yeah, Miss Amy Mann from Till Tuesday, who at the time they had a big hit. I'm trying to remember what it was called right now, but
Till Tuesday.
Big hit.
Huge. Yeah, it was a big hit. Well, you can tell I wasn't a big fan of their band, but she was not the first person that Rush actually approached to sing on Time Stand Still on Hold Your Fire. Folks, think about female artists at the time that were really selling.
Oh, what's that girl, Katie Lang?
No. Katie Lang?
I don't know. Shania Twain.
Cindy Lauper.
No.
Was the first person. Now, I can't imagine how. Now, keep in mind, though, mid-80s, you know, one of the
girls
biggest.
Girls just want to have fun.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, and she probably just thought, who the fuck is Rush? And I'm not having anything to do with it. So then they moved on to Miss Chrissy Hynde.
Oh.
And of course, they were also doing very well at the time.
Right? The Pretenders,
and she also didn't return to calls or whatever.
Who the fuck is Rush?
So then they decide to ask Amy Mann. And I was just reading about this the other day. So I remember it. They paid her $2,000. To come on and sing, sing. Actually, she sings on Time Stand Still, but she also does backing vocals on a few other songs as well. So there you have it.
She's got a great voice.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, she did well. Her big $2,000 payday.
You know what, though, that's not a bad payday for a vocal track. Like, for how popular was she at the time?
She was so popular that I now remember the name of the song, "Voices Carry."
Oh.
See, I don't know any of
remember
this.
That song?
No.
Yeah, of course, man.
You got to look it up. Do not put it on the Rush set list we're doing now.
I've got that in my playlist for the 80s.
Yeah, there you go.
I do.
Yeah. Voices Carry.
What I'll do is I'll put a link to that song in the show notes there if you want to hear it. Okay. But we won't put it on the Spotify playlist.
I'll be checking that out right after the show.
It's good but, to you know the tune. Once you hear it.
You'll know. I mean, I could sing it for you right now, but it's terrible. So
we'll get sued.
So we will say,
not for the use of the song, for your bad vocals, I mean.
Yeah, that too. Unless I could have some backing tracks. But the only thing I want to comment about this, because we've been shitting on Rush music and how it was the guitar was really not that prevalent. This album, even though they will say there was still a lot of keyboards, there is one song I want you to go listen to it later, Lock and Key, that to me is the pinnacle of how they actually use keyboards and guitar in the same song. And there's a solo section where actually there's a guitar solo, but it's counterpunched with keyboard parts in it. And it's fucking brilliant as far as I'm concerned. It's probably my favorite song on that album. So take a listen to Lock and Key later and you'll see what I mean. It's a really an excellent song, but it's that solo part where really, I think Alex just said, okay, fuck this.
Here we go.
Yeah. I'm playing.
Yeah.
And, but they did eventually, as we all know, get to more guitar-oriented albums as they continued on.
Right. So then they make their way to the end of the 80s. In 1989, they start to return to some more of their guitar-oriented roots. And they released the album Presto, 1989. Right, Giz?
Absolutely. Yep. And this was another one that, they introduced Rupert Hine, who I believe had worked with a band called The Fix, was kind of his,
great band.
His thing. The Fix. Dude, if I'm not mistaken.
One thing leads to another.
Come on. Yeah. What's, you bring up 80s? The Fix.
Oh, The Fix is great.
God, they're great, man.
Yeah. So that's so that's who they chose, and he actually plays, or he was their producer for Roll the Bones as well. So he did two in a row for them, and I really like this album. Again, they started to go back as well to having some instrumentals, which they had not had for the last few albums, as you'll recall, and then they started to introduce instrumentals again, which really hadn't done in quite a long time. But this was a really good album, and I think for Alex in particular, he started to get a little happier with this album. There was a lot more guitar in this.
Is that album cover the same artist? The same?
Yeah. It's always Hugh Syme. It always has been, right to the bitter end.
I love the album cover for Presto. It's got the magician's hat and all the rabbits on the hill. It's great. Great album cover.
Yeah, no, it was great. And again, that was another album that, you know, Show Don't Tell became one of their tour openers for a while after that as well. So, it was just a good, strong album. It really was.
Very good.
And then, well, you already mentioned Roll the Bones.
Yeah, Roll the Bones was interesting because, you know, as we were talking earlier about the reggae and ska elements in Moving Pictures and Signals, they introduced some rap and rap.
Oh, well, I don't know if I'd call it rap.
This became a very kind of misaligned song for a lot of Rush fans. They were able to let go a lot of things, but as soon as they started to hear the rap, and it's interesting, you'll hear all kinds of stories about who actually recorded. Is it Neil? Is it Getty? I
thought it was Alex.
No, I'm pretty sure they actually talk about it in one of the Rush books I just finished, and I'm pretty sure that it's actually Getty, just with his voice doctored, and he actually he does it. But you know, overall, again, you know, I like that album.
It went platinum. I mean, it did well.
Yeah,
you know, it won the Juno Award in 1992 for the best album design. Which is kind of cool.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That is neat. I actually didn't know that.
Yeah.
There you go. So that moves them, again, just pumping out albums every couple of years.
Pumping them out.
So then 1993 comes Counterparts.
Yeah. And this is the album that oftentimes rock critics would say, oh, this is Rush trying to be grunge. And of course it was 93, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's at the heart of when, you know, Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, Nirvana, all of these bands were big at that time. It was the grunge period. Now, Alex and Getty and Neil will say, no, we did not give a shit about grunge. More so when you listen to Alex talk, it's, no, I finally won, and we're going to start doing more guitar-oriented rock.
Back to the basics.
And this album really does that. Yeah, this is a really good one. There's one song on there I really enjoy in particular, Double Agent. It's a great song. You should listen to that one. But it's got some really great songs on this.
Stick It Out.
Love it. Yeah.
Yeah. That was their 15th studio album.
Like I said, they kept putting them out every 15. For a while there was one every year. And then every couple years, they just kept on going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just reminded that this was also the time when Neil decided that, he probably never ever said, I'm the world's greatest drummer, but he actually said, you know what, I need to become more improvisational instead of so calculated with my drum parts. So he actually hired a drum coach, Freddie Gruber, who was a real jazz genius. And even at the time, Freddie was probably in his late 60s or 70s. And it's funny reading Neil's accounting of that time that he really just tore Neil's drumming apart. And they just went right back to basics. And it's interesting, if you do listen to this album compared to some of the others, you really see a difference in Neil's drumming style. It just becomes a lot more fluid.
I got to revisit this album. I haven't heard this in a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, for him going to that coach that you just mentioned, Giz, I remember part of the documentary where Neil says, the revelation I had was when he told me, he says, you're too choppy. You got to be more flow. You got to feel it. You got to flow from one piece of the apparatus to mm-hmm. the other. And Neil said that made all the difference.
Something about it's not about the contact of the drum. It's about the movement of your hands.
Right. Didn't he change his grip?
Well, he changed it to more of a jazz style. He changed his grip style as well. But he also started doing work with other jazz bands and artists. And he was asked by the Buddy Rich family, actually, to do a couple of albums worth. They actually, there's volume one and two, where he does old jazz standards. And he's just playing on a four-piece and banging out jazz-style drumming. They're really good if you just for something different to listen to and listen to what. And I think for Neil, it was his ability to say, yeah, I can do the rock stuff, but I can also do this, which he always said was way more complicated than what he was playing.
And a lot of people, you know, didn't know, I guess some people did know about Neil Peart, is that he did not like to be the center of attention. And what he called it, the meridian line, where he didn't cross for the front of the stage. He always stayed behind it with his kit. Even at the end of the show, he'd leave. He would never go to the front of the stage.
He never crossed that. His domain was behind that line.
Yeah, he didn't like the spotlight or public attention. He did it attention. Once. Yeah.
The he only once, time yeah. he ever did it was the last night.
Very last show. Caught Getty off surprise.
Yeah, they had no idea he was going to do that.
He tapped him on the shoulder.
Yeah, right? Whoa, Neil's up front? What's going on?
He said,
this is a surprise.
Classic picture.
Yeah, you know what, though? Really I give him credit because at that time, everybody was holding him up as, okay, this guy, he's the best drummer in the world. And yet, he's hiring a coach.
Which shows you can always learn something new, right?
It's amazing.
It just goes to show you he didn't have a huge ego.
He did not.
No.
Right?
No. Right.
Very down-to-earth guy.
Little note here. You know the song on there, Leave That Thing Alone? It's an instrumental track mm-hmm. they did. It was actually nominated at the 1994 Grammy Awards for Best Rock Instrumental Performance.
Wow. Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, they always name their instrumentals like that. There's Where's My Thing? There's Leave That Thing Alone.
Yeah.
Later in their albums, they had Main Monkey Business. There was a whole bunch of different ones that they came up with. And they all have a tongue-in-cheek kind of story behind them. But, yeah.
I think they should have made I Think I'm Going Bald. No lyrics.
Yeah, well, the next album we're going to talk about is one they should have made with no lyrics. Test for Echo.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
1996. Why do you say that?
You know, it's the most dated thing that they have ever written. It just seems so uninspired. The writing on that album, to me, is the weakest that Neil ever did. And it's the most dated because there's a lot of references to early kind of technology when it comes to modems and whatnot. And it just sounds so outdated now when you listen to it. And I remember when that album came out, it's the one that I literally listened to it one time through and then I thought, okay, and maybe didn't listen to it for quite a while later. And of course, it led into a tragic hiatus for Rush.
Selena, yeah.
But to me, and they talk about it in some interviews, that this was a point where they really weren't sure if they actually even wanted to continue anyway. Neil was getting more and more kind of not interested in touring. And there'd been several times throughout their time leading up to that Neil had kind of said it was game time decision whether or not he even wanted to continue even touring. And to me, it did seem like this was a really uninspired album.
So I said Selena. I mean, we're talking about his daughter dying in that car accident. Car crash.
Yeah, right. Selena, right. Yeah.
I mean, they finished recording in July of 97, that album, Test for Echo. And then in August, a month later, his daughter died in that tragic accident.
He escorted her part of the way there and then
She was 19 and just starting college, right?
Yep. Yes, and then a year later, his wife, common-law wife, died of cancer. And it was after that time that Neil basically had told the guys in the band that he's retired and he's done. And off he went on a bicycle journey. that he never intended on going as far as he
did. Did you say bicycle?
Oh, sorry. Did I say bicycle?
Bicycle. Back it up. Bicycle.
I want yeah, it was ride. Not his bicycle. It was his BMW bike.
He was motorcycle. He was a big motorcycle enthusiast.
He was, yes. Yeah. And so he started to travel, and he went all through the U.S. He actually went down to South America, all the way back up to Alaska. And the whole time he did that, he was journaling the whole thing. And it turned into a book called Ghost Rider, Travels on the Healing Road, which for anyone who's going through grief, I would highly recommend it. It's just a great book about grief and overcoming grief. It obviously led to, it was a five-year hiatus. And
he went by himself, right?
He went by himself.
88,000 kilometers.
Wow.
55,000 miles.
And he said, out of all that traveling, he firmly believes he wasn't recognized once. Out of all the stops and then, because he'd be casual, stop for something to eat, whatever. He wasn't even recognized.
And that's what he wanted.
That's what he wanted, yeah.
Well, and he always took the back roads, even in later tours when he would tour with his, he had a traveling buddy, Brutus, one of his, that was his nickname anyway, one of his best friends, Brutus. And they would always take the road less traveled. He would have Brutus plan out a route that did not take them on major roads or freeways. They would take they would stay in these roadside motels, and he didn't give a shit about, you know, staying at the Ritz-Carlton or anything else. He never, ever did. So, while Alex and Getty were flying around in their airplanes and staying in nice hotels, Neil was just staying in little roadside motels and eating, deli food. He was quite happy.
That's the best part of riding motorcycles, taking the back roads, winding roads in through little towns. It's very relaxing. It's good. If you're on a highway, it's tense.
It reminds me of, I think it's in that book, actually. He talks about once when he was recognized and a guy comes up to him and says, "You're Neil Peart." And Neil says, "Not today."
Yeah. Good
answer. And he walked away. Yeah. Yeah. But that that led to basically a five-year hiatus. And it was during that time that Alex wrote his solo album, Victor, which is really hard to come by these days. If you can find that on vinyl, good luck.
I'll be looking.
And it's interesting because we'll talk about it later about Alex's latest project, and it's really far different from any Rush music. And of course, Getty also did his solo album, My Favorite Headache, which is really, really good. If you've not listened to it, it's really worth a listen. And to me, it shows what Getty actually brought to Rush, which was more of the melodic side and kind of standard songwriting. It's really, really good. I still listen to it to this day. It's such a great, great album.
So they were on for 5 years, and then they finally get together again in the early 2000s. Alex and Neil get together and say, look at, I guess Alex and Getty thought it was over.
They thought it was over.
Yeah, they thought it was done. And then Alex and Neil got together, and they started to do some things, and they came up with the Vapor Trails.
Well, when did Alex start having issues with his hands?
Arthritis.
It started to appear back in around that time. He's been dealing with it for quite a long time, just never really spoke a lot of it. But they all started to have that. Neil was having some problems as well. But when you read stories about this time, Neil said he basically had to relearn how to drum. He had not touched the drums in nearly 5 years.
Yeah.
But Vapor Trails is like listening to an entire album of grieving. It's done very, very well. It's not so overt, but songs like Vapor Trails and are incredible songs. But it's really a different album, and I don't want to call it bleak, but it's certainly very personal. It's probably the most personal album that Neil has ever written.
Well, we should mention that in those 5 years, near the end of it, Neil gets remarried. Right.
So, yeah, he does. Yeah, to Carrie Nuttall, who's a well-known photographer and visual artist in L.A.
Yeah, so they get married in 2000, and then Neil and Alex hook up again in 2001. So Neil is on the recovery pathway.
Yep, but he said at the time that he was in L.A. and that's it. So we record here, although they did record in Toronto as well. But their days of moving around and traveling the globe and recording in other parts of the world ended then. But
I mean, which band toured more than Rush? I mean, they were all over the place all the time.
Yeah, it's quite something. But they, you know, on that opening track, and I'm sure it was not done unintentionally, is Neil starting off with a pretty vicious drum kind of, I won't call it a solo, but he starts it off with an intro that's just Neil on drums. And that's then each cool. of them actually come in one at a time. And, you know, it's like, nice. I just give myself goosebumps because, you know, for them, that was their return and that they never thought they were ever going to make another album. And quite honestly, after this, they really didn't make any promises for anything after that. It was just one at a time. But that one to me, there's no solos. Alex did not want to do any solos, so you can listen to the entire album. There's not a single solo on that album.
Really?
The closest thing that comes to it is at the end of Earthshine, which is my favorite song, and he kind of does an outro there, but it's even the outro, and I always go, God damn it, why they let him just keep going for another about 40 seconds or so.
Yeah.
And in live, actually, he does. He does actually continue the solo if you ever heard that song live. But they did it very purposely. They wanted to be a three-piece band playing just a three-piece and very, very few keyboards. There was nothing. It was just the three of them.
It's nice. Funny you mentioned keyboards. It's the first album. Vapor Trails is the first album since Caress of Steel not to include any keyboards or synthesizers. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm.
A little side note.
It's a very good album.
Yeah. I can't wait. I'm getting pumped here. I want to go. I just want to go start listening to Rush again. Mm-hmm. Right? Everything.
Yeah. Well, especially when you know the meaning and the time frame that these albums, what they represent and what they've gone through. Yeah, it's quite a journey, actually.
Well, I mean, Vapor Churros also, their concert in Brazil, São Paulo, was one of the biggest concerts.
That was huge.
60,000 people in a stadium showed up to hear Rush. Amazing.
Yeah, they've been waiting a long time. Even Rush said they had no idea how rabid the fans were there. They had no idea that's what they were going to be faced with when they went there. They did deal with some of the elements, too. I remember reading an article not too long ago that there was a lot of rain. There was tropical storms that happened around the same time. And so the whole idea of moving their equipment from one concert to the next was quite a battle as well. So,
well, after the 6 years of not touring, it was Mexico City and São Paulo were their first two concerts in over 6 years.
Yeah.
And one of them was 60,000 people.
That's crazy.
They've got video of that. You really don't. That 60,000 sounds like a lot, but when you... talking about people, and you see, like, the vantage point from the stage looking out is a shot of Neil behind Neil Peart and looking out, like, holy crap, that is a lot of people, man. Just to see, you know, three guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing.
Yeah. You know, Vapor Trails is over 67 minutes long, that album. And there's 13 tracks on there, and two of them are at the 6 minute mark. But everything else was less than that. But that's a lot of songs. Well,
that's a lot of grief you got to write about, I guess.
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That, like I said, there's some, you know, that one little victory. You should listen to that with headphones on in particular for the drum intro to that, which is just incredible. What a great intro to that song.
Nice. Okay.
It actually hit number 3 on the Canadian charts, eh, that album.
Nice.
Yeah, that's good.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, number 3.
Good stuff. Yeah, it did well. Yeah, so they followed that up with Snakes and Arrows, which was, you know, it's interesting because producers, one thing that Rush was always really keen to do was always bring in different producers to be pushed and you know, into a different direction and have someone else who could really help them along. And for this album, this is the first one that they used Nick Raskulinets, who was a young kind of punk producer who was most well known for working with Foo Fighters. And the story goes that Nick had heard through some people that Rush were looking for a producer. He didn't want to let on how much of a Rush geek he was. So he remembers walking in and just kind of, you know, yeah, I want to work with you guys and whatever. When he finally got the gig is when it really came out that of how much of a Rush fan he was. But he became really well known, and him and Neil in particular really hit it off. They actually, Neil gave him a nickname called Bijoux, And it was Nick used to count off Neil for drum parts and say to him, Neil, come on, you're Neil Peart. Play, like, I know you can play more than what you're playing there. And he used to really push him. And of course, Neil would, all of the band were not wanting to overplay for the sake of overplaying, but Neil really wanted them to, or Nick, sorry, really wanted them to, play like you're Rush. Just, you know what? You guys can do it. So just play like that. And this is actually an album that features three instrumentals, the most on any Rush album ever. And it was really a chance for Geddy to rest his voice a little bit, but also for them just to rock out. And nice. The whole album was written like that. It was written, most of the music was written first, and then really with Lee and with Geddy and Alex having already kind of done a lot of the work on pre-recording the tracks, Neil came in with the lyrics, and then they just kind of fit it, which is what they did with a lot of the other albums that came, the two other albums that came after that, but...
Now this is 2007. I should mention that they did release a live album.
They did.
Yeah, in 2003. It was the last concert they gave in Rio. And it was called Rush in Rio.
Yeah, Rio was
But it was, amazing. It was a live album that they released for that concert.
Yeah.
But that was 4 years earlier.
But Snakes and Arrows, if you remember the kids' game, Snakes and Ladders, everyone remembers that game?
Oh, yeah.
Of course.
So that's actually, Snakes and Arrows is based off of a Hindu belief around the doorway to heaven or the ladder to heaven or the stairwell down to hell. And Snakes and Ladders, that's actually what that game really represents. Hmm. The original is Snakes and Arrows. And so this whole album has kind of, it has that kind of a slant on it where there's a lot of Hindu kind of mythology or religion that's built into
Hare
the songs.
Krishna in there.
And a lot of religion. And Neil was a certainly not a religious person. Depending on who you listen to, he was either atheist or agnostic. And this is his anti-religion album. If you listen to it and listen to the lyrics, you really see that he really wanted to make a statement on this album, and it was really actually about how much organized religion is just bullshit. And in some of his, we haven't really talked about it, but of course, Neil was also a very avid writer of books, and in some of his books, there's one called Traveling Music, which is really good. And he used to stop and take pictures of billboards outside of churches and then really just tear them apart in the book about how much bullshit it was. But this was really his album where he really brought that out about his religion. And you never really saw that before, but in this one, it's pretty clear that he was not a church-going lad. But I love this album. And again, for Alex... I think after Counterparts, right up through this, Alex was very, very happy with what was happening from a guitar standpoint. He's all over this album. It's one that you don't really hear. Not a lot of Rush fans. I think a lot of Rush fans didn't really stick with them. After even Test for Echo, there wasn't a lot of people didn't keep up with the later Rush. You know, they just listened to Moving Pictures and whatever and don't think anything really came after that. Mm-hmm. But... you know, to me, this is the third stage of their career. And to me, it's actually, I love this stage probably as much as I love the early 70s stuff. To me, no other band has ever ended a career like Rush did.
Well, and we talked before when they first started, the media and, you know, they did not get good press. They weren't received well. The fans loved them, but the media and the music writers never had a good thing to say about them. So as you say, later on in their career, they start to be recognized. I mean, they showed up on the Colbert Report in July and were interviewed by Stephen Colbert. They were on, and they performed Tom Sawyer on the show.
And Neil even showed up.
Yeah, Neil.
He doesn't do that shit.
No, I'm sure he wasn't.
I was surprised.
No, he must have to twist his arm for that. He doesn't do much of that.
And even in 2009, they had like a cameo appearance in the movie I Love You, Man, with Paul Rudd and Jason Segel.
Yeah, that's
I don't
great.
Remember that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's
I remember. Great. I remember them in Trailer Park Boys, but wasn't Geddy that. Or something or Alex?
Alex has played a couple of characters in Trailer Park Boys. Yeah,
that's hilarious.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah, so they start to become more recognized by the industry, But if you watch those documentaries, the musicians who knew these guys and knew what their skill levels were said, these guys are awesome. Never mind what the critics say. They don't know what they're talking about.
Ultimate respect for these three guys.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Another side note, another Grammy Award nomination for another instrumental off of that album.
Snakes and Arrows?
Off of Snakes and Arrows. Mm-hmm. Called Malignant Narcissism. And that was actually nominated for Best Rock Instrumental.
Wow. Mm.
Yeah.
There's an interesting story about that song, actually, because they had already packed up everything. And when they were doing the mix for the album, they're like, you know what? We still have a few minutes left here. You guys should record like a little instrumental to throw in there. And Neil's super kit had already been dismantled. And the only thing that was there was a practice kit, like a 4-piece drum kit. So go back and listen to that again and know that he only played like literally a 3 or 4-piece drum kit. That's what he plays on.
Kidding.
And so they recorded that as kind of a like, all right, yeah, let's just get in and do something. And Neil does that on literally a practice kit that just happened to be set up there at the studio.
He could play on Tupperware and make it sound good.
Yeah, he could. He
really could.
That's awesome.
So that's 2009. So we're getting into the last part of the first decade there in the 2000s. And what comes up next? Is it Clockwork Angels?
That's their last one.
That was the last one, which, what a way to go out.
Yeah.
And it's interesting when you, to me, that album, still one of my favorite Rush albums. If I had to say top five, it's probably number two on the top five
list.
Yeah. Yeah, I know I played that, some of it for you before. To me, it's the most guitar-heavy album that they made since the early 70s stuff. And a lot of it was very improvisational as well. And this was, again, produced by Nick Raskolnitz. So he came back and produced this album as well. And they really tried to just, go all out on this one. And Nick was constantly trying to push Neil to say, no, you could do more on that drum fill. And if you listen to the drums on this album, to me, it's the most free that Neil has ever played in any Rush album. But there are some songs on this album with like 2-minute instrumental breaks before you even get into singing. Like, they just went all out on this one. And to me, it's an incredible way that no one knew, obviously, that it was going to be their last album, although they were certainly, by that point, with arthritis and all the other issues that Neil was having, it was probably going to be near the end. And let's be honest, Getty's voice is not what it was back in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But he could still deliver, and really because of the way he changed his vocal delivery in the 90s, to sing in a different register, and really you see that big difference between, even really with Moving Pictures on.
Yeah. Now, I love the fact that in 2010, they were also inducted into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame, the band Rush.
Yes.
All three of them had input to the songs. Neil is a lyricist, and the other two are songwriters, music writers. It's great recognition for them.
Yeah, and it's funny, you listen to the final song on this album. It's called The Garden, and they call it kind of part two of Losing It from Signals, where it's about someone kind of losing their talents and kind of near the end of your career or the twilight of your career. And it's very, it's always been called kind of eerie the way that the lyrics are written, because it's really about, being near the end of your life or whatever the case might be. And it's been proven that Neil did not know that he had his diagnosis at this time, but it's written like a goodbye. It's incredibly
eerie.
It really is.
Yeah.
And it's a very powerful song. There's a lot of strings in it. And when they did it live, they did have a 4-string section that came with them, cello and violins that they used on this album as well. But it's a very, very powerful album. It's incredible.
That's a 7-minute song, too, The Garden.
Yeah, it's something else.
So after the tour for Clockwork Angels, they agreed to take a year off. So we need to take a year off, especially especially Neil. Neil was worn out.
Yeah, he was worn out. And really, you know, it was not much longer after that that they figure that, because we're kind of at that stage of talking about Neil, it wasn't long after that that he actually got his diagnosis. But as we all know, he kept it quiet for about at least four years, that nobody knew he had cancer except his inner circle. Mm-hmm. And in articles and interviews you read, you know, Neil and Getty would go and, Getty and Alex would go see him from time to time, but he basically wanted to keep it, really wanted to keep it quiet. And even Neil has been quoted as saying that he didn't want people outside, you know, singing Closer to the Heart. Yeah. You know, he took a very pragmatic view to it all and just said he would enjoy whatever time he had mm-hmm. left, and that's what he wanted to do.
And during that year off was when they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
2013.
Yes.
2013, yeah. So it was in April. And watching the reception they got when they were announced.
Yeah, watch that on YouTube, right?
They're announcing a bunch of other bands. Yeah.
Now, mind you, there's some great bands. Like, some of my favorites were in there.
Yeah.
Heart was nominated that year.
Yeah.
Randy Newman.
Yeah.
Donna Summer. There's some big...
And then they say Rush.
And the place just went
The place blew
nuts.
Up. Every fan in the place.
I love the introduction, though. Was it the Foo Fighters?
Dave Grohl.
Dave Grohl.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Taylor Hawkins.
You can just tell these guys just loved Rush.
And by the way, the producer, Nick, is the bass player. So when Taylor Hawkins and Dave Grohl are doing 2112, dressed in the kimonos, go back and watch it. It's the producer, Nick, that's actually playing bass.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, he played bass as well. He was a musician besides being a producer. But it's really interesting because, when Jan Wenner said, and this band from Toronto or however they introduced it, they didn't even say Rush. No. Everyone just went crazy.
Yeah,
I actually tried to get tickets for that. That was like winning the lottery. I never got tickets for that, but I certainly tried. But that was an awesome moment.
Dave Grohl, actually, he says, screwed Rolling Stone or whatever he says, right?
Yeah.
Because the Rolling Stone
they
really...
Yeah, they don't know shit.
Yeah.
Well, of course, and then Alex did his famous blah, blah, blah speech where he just said blah, blah,
man,
blah for 3.5 minutes or whatever it was. And even on the Rush website now, you can still buy shirts that just say blah, blah, blah. And,
that's funny.
And, you know, it's funny because... Of course, Neil and Getty had no idea that he was going to do that. And Getty has said that he started to get really irritated near the end because he thought, okay, all right, he's going to say blah, blah, blah for a little bit, but he just didn't stop. Yeah. It's funny to watch it.
He just didn't give a shit.
And he was telling a story. Alex won't explain kind of what he was talking about, but the way he was saying blah, 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 he didn't just say blah, blah, blah over and over. He was using it and using different tones the way he was saying it. And he said, no, I was telling something, but I'll never tell what that really was. But he was, you know, he might have been telling Jan Wenner to go.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was pretty neat. They also got the keys to the city in a ceremony as well. I'm trying to remember exactly when that was. I think it was about 5 years ago
what
now.
What city?
Toronto.
Willowdale. Yeah,
we just got to mention it.
Yeah, so they, I actually went there for that as well. That was really neat.
Cool.
So they have there's a park in Willowdale. It's called the Lee Lifeson Park, and it's an interactive park. There's all kinds of musical elements around the park where you can go hit things but they have a sound stage there that's meant to focus on, you know.
So Lee Lifeson, just because Peart was from St. Catharines, he doesn't get a mention.
Yeah, he didn't get the invite.
Yeah, but Neil, the thing in Port Dalhousie, Lakeside Park, what's that?
The Pavilion.
That got named after him.
Yeah, it is named after him, yeah. And there's still actually, there's quite a bit of money raised through Rush fan pages and stuff to actually have, and they are commissioning some kind of a work of art there as well. They're still trying to figure it out, but there is going to be something else besides just the pavilion named after Neil. So
he's such a modest, low key guy, very intelligent. Didn't like to be in the spotlight, but was killer at what he did.
Yeah, he sure was.
Yeah, good for him. So that led into leading into the latter part of 2013, led them into the R40 tour, right?
Yeah, so they didn't stop touring. They obviously kept doing it. That's actually a tour. I did see that tour as well. That was a great tour. Right. If I'm not mistaken, it's the one where they did things in reverse order. They started with the most recent album.
Yeah.
And then went all the way back, and the soundstage or the set changed every couple of songs, and they would bring out elements of that tour. And cool ended with just a red curtain from, you know, the days of playing in the high schools, and they came out and just did a couple of the early songs. I'm trying to remember the name of it now, but anyway, a couple of songs that never actually got recorded on Rush albums. They actually did a couple snippets from that.
But didn't they end their very last show with one of those a snippet of one of those? They did "Working Man" as their final song, but right. then they did that.
Yeah, I think it's called Garden Road.
That's what it is. Yeah, we were talking about the garden.
Yeah, it's Garden Road. I thought
that reminds me of the song they finished.
So they actually finished with a little snippet, just instrumental from that. But so that was a great tour. I actually saw that in Toronto, I believe.
That's really cool.
That was an awesome show.
You actually got to see that.
Yeah, it was really neat.
Yeah.
So what was the date of the very last show? It was in Los Angeles, right?
It was L.A. Yeah.
It was L.A. August 1st, 2015 at the Forum in L.A. That was the final show.
Yeah, and that's the one where, Neil finally comes up front.
Yeah, he didn't make a habit of doing that at all in their entire career.
First time ever. Like, did he say, Queeks? He said it's...
Well, no, he said it was the, what do you call it? The back meridian. It was the back meridian.
He said it wasn't his territory up front.
Yeah, he would,
didn't go there.
So actually, at the end of the, when they finished Working Man, and then they did a snippet of Garden Road, Geddy Lee is telling the crowd, thank you, you know, for the 40 years. It's been awesome years. We hope to meet you again sometime. Bye-bye. And as he's delivering that, Neil Peart comes walking out, taps him on the shoulder, then goes over and gets Alex. And they bring them all together up front.
And it's the only time there are pictures of the three of them standing up front together on the stage at the end of a concert.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite something. There's actually, I have a photo of that I've got framed in my little Rush room. But it's actually taken from behind. Yeah. So it's really neat.
I've seen that picture. Yeah. Actually, Neil brings a camera out, doesn't he? He comes out and takes a picture. Of them, remember?
He takes a picture from where he's sitting.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then
he did.
Yeah, it's great. This gives you goosebumps, really.
Well, just to know what kind of respect they had for one another. They were just good guys. They got along. They were family guys. They weren't involved in all the debauchery that you usually hear about in rock and roll. And they were talented.
They really were.
And well-respected within the industry.
Yeah, most people thought that's definitely going to be the end anyway. Not many Rush fans thought that you would see much more come out of the band after that. And, of course, like we were just talking about, it, of course, ended in the untimely passing of Neil January 7th, 2020, which was a shock for everybody. I still remember reading that. I couldn't believe I was reading.
He was only 67 years old.
Yeah, he was still young. He had remarried, as we had said, and actually had a young daughter who was only 13, I believe, at the time. And he used to go to his daughter's school, and he would introduce himself as a retired drummer. And he would volunteer at the library at his daughter's school. He just wanted to live his life and not do it anymore, which no one could fault him for it. And even after that, I mean, obviously, and we'll talk about here in a minute, Alex and Geddy have maintained quite a busy schedule, actually, for two people who are retired from music. But there's quite a few things that they're still involved in.
You know, we could probably pick up another show on that.
Yeah, pick up.
There's probably enough, right? Gizmo, right?
There's quite a bit that they've been doing since then. Yeah,
absolutely. I think we'd be into a follow-up show. What do you think?
So, Life After Rush?
Life After Rush. Hey.
Very good. How did you think of that?
I don't know. How about Life's an After Rush?
Ooh. Or Part 3.
Well, I mean, what always impressed me about Neil is that he was a voracious reader. He just couldn't get enough. the knowledge that guy had. And like I said,
yeah, he's very smart dude.
Yeah, when they had him do the lyrics, mm-hmm. as you know, one of the main lyricists for the band, they said, nobody's got a vocabulary like him. Like, we're stupid compared to this guy. Let him write the lyrics.
Well, like Getty said, you know, Neil's always reading, like, hey, maybe he can write lyrics.
I know.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah, he certainly did. Yeah, I mean, there's lots to talk about because obviously, even just going back through Neil's his written collection of books that he's had over the years. I mean, it's just amazing what his legacy of what he leaves behind, the written work beyond just Rush lyrics is unreal.
And what you know, Alex said, there's no way that Rush can ever exist again because Neil's not here.
Well, he was quoted as saying, right, if all of us are not on board at any time, that's it. We just don't go on. That's it.
Yeah. That's impressive.
Yeah.
It is support for each other and respect. Yeah. Unlike some of the other bands we've talked about in the past.
Yikes.
Yikes.
Yeah. So that's Rush Part 2. And sounds like we're going to do another Rush episode down the road, you know, Life After Rush, whatever we want to call it.
It won't be a Rush episode, but it'll be a Geddy Lee Alex Lifeson episode, maybe. How's that sound?
Yeah,
Life After Music. There's probably a lot of other bands that we can talk about that have gone on to do other things after they kind of retired from music.
Maybe try to get Alex on the show for 10 or 15 minutes.
Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah. Come on, Giz, you got an in.
Yeah. I'll just show him my picture of him and I and say, hey, come on, you remember me?
Yeah, yeah.
Giz.
Hundreds of thousands of other people.
I actually did say that to him, by the way, the second time I met him. I said, don't you remember me, Alex? I met you like 3 years ago.
Oh, my God.
We had a...
You're very memorable.
Of course, said it tongue-in-cheek, but it was he had a good laugh at that.
Yeah, good stuff. Great. All right, so that's Rush Part 2. Now we're going to get into a little bit of the news segment at the end of the podcast.
All right, so a little bit of news. Metallica fans out there, Kirk Hammett, been playing guitar for about around 40 years. He's finally coming out with a solo release for himself. It's a 4-song instrumental EP called Portals. Comes out April 23rd.
4-song.
Of 2022.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
So this is the week, we should mention, this is the week of February 10th, 2022. So the little segment we also do is on this day in history, right?
Let's talk about that.
There you go. We got Queeks.
February 10th, on this day, 1942, Glenn Miller, his recording Chattanooga Choo Choo, and him and his orchestra became the first to receive a gold record. It was actually just a master copy of the disc sprayed with gold lacquer by RCA as a publicity stunt.
Yeah, and then the gold record became a thing after that.
That's right.
And you know what? I bought that CD, the Glenn Miller.
So did I.
I have it. I know how many Glenn Miller albums I have. I bet you I got like 7.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was around our house growing up as well, Glenn Miller. A lot of that was played.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just in the mood, baby. In the mood.
Yeah, I know. It's classic. Yeah.
And Marty Robbins.
Marty Robbins.
Oh, man. I remember Marty Robbins.
I got vinyl by Marty Robbins as well.
Oh, wow.
El Paso. Yeah.
Yes, El Paso. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Do you know the first gold single, not album, but gold single, was awarded to Perry Como in 1958 for Catch a Falling Star. There you go.
That's a long time ago.
There you go. Just a little note.
Thanks for that little bit of trivia.
That was a while ago. Yeah.
Okay, so more on this date or around this date?
Yeah, well, on this date in 78, Van Halen released their first album, and this one obviously went on to sell over 10 million copies and really propelled them into superstardom.
And it was called Van Halen.
Van Halen. Yeah.
No guff, yeah.
Of course, featured Eruption, which was Eddie's, really his showcase instrumental that really showed off his two-finger tapping.
Which led into the song, You Really Got Me.
You Really Got Me, yes. Yeah.
That's a great album.
By the Kinks.
I love it. It's a great party album back then.
Oh, yeah, man. Ice Cream Man.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Come on, that's a classic too.
Anything else happening on this day?
On this day, 1971, Carole King released her second studio album, Tapestry.
That was huge for her.
Wow, it was great. Won Grammy Award for Album of the Year. Sold over 25 million copies worldwide. It's a huge album. I got 2 copies of that on vinyl.
Good stuff.
Have it. Oh, yeah.
Is that for redundancy? For case one breaks.
Man, I'm just hanging on to it.
Gotcha.
Whenever, if I'm out shopping and I see an album on sale, if you see Tapestry in great condition, I don't care if you got 12 copies. You take, you grab it. It's Tapestry, man.
What's the album you said you're still looking for?
Oh, Band on the Run.
Oh, Band on the Run. Oh, you know, yeah. I just can't find a good copy of it. I can't believe I don't have it, but I need that album.
Mm. There you go. In good condition.
In good condition.
Yeah. If you come across any Menudo, just let me know.
Yeah, they're all over the thrift store. Nobody.
Who's
wants
that other guy, Simmons or whatever the hell he was talking about earlier?
Who?
Gene Simmons? What?
No, Simmons. Cody something.
Oh, Cody Simpson.
Cody Simpson.
Simpson. Yeah, that guy.
Yeah. Actually, he...
Oh, you have a signed CD.
He went
with
out with Miley Cyrus.
Did he?
Went out on tour or went out on a date?
Dating. Dating, yeah. I like the early Cody. Well, it was just a moment with my daughter. It was just fun.
There you go.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Here, look, one little... On this day, I got to mention this because it's pretty... interesting. Elton John, 1973, on this day, had his first UK number one album with "Don't Shoot Me, I'm only the Piano Player." So that was his first that went number one in the UK. Hmm. Just saying.
Interesting.
6 week run at the top of the charts.
There we go.
Yeah.
All right, so we're gonna wrap up this episode.
There we go.
I don't know what Giz is doing over there, but we're going to say thank you to Giz for joining us on this episode of Rush Part 2. Thanks, Giz.
Great to be here.
Thank you. So come back again to listen to some Inside Rock with Oat,
Queeks,
and Cha,
and the Jabber Guys. Remember to go to our website, jabberguys.com, to subscribe to our podcasts, Inside Rock and Weird and Wacky World.